Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working at...
An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, hello, everyone. Chuck Bonnell, Julie Hayden on this beautiful Monday. This is a Chuck and Julie grassroots show, True Straight Up.
And the show is brought to you by Mountain West Wellness, Advanced Acupuncture, and Chinese Medicine. As soon as we get him on the phone, we're going to be talking to Todd Sheets. We've had him on the show before talking about economic collapses in the economy, and he's got a lot of good thoughts on the whole tariff situation, which has now become a totally... The media, who before, I think, Chuck, would never in a million years write about tariffs because they were so boring, now does it every day. And Wall Street keeps screwing them up by going up and down. You know, as soon as they say, oh, the economy is going to collapse, we're in a recession, then it rebounds, and then they're like, whoa, that doesn't have anything to do with Trump, and then it collapses, and they're like, but that does have to do with Trump. So, I mean, it's ridiculous. So we'll have Todd on to talk a little bit about what's going on there. The governor's race in Colorado is getting a little bit interesting, too, and so we'll talk about that. But right now, we do have Todd with us. Todd Sheets is the author of the newsletter On Wealth and Progress, which is currently available for free on Substack, and of the book, which we've talked to him about before, 2008, What Really Happened, and has a great new column up on his Substack, the first of a few-part series on the tariffs. So, hey, Todd, thanks you once again for your time. Appreciate it.
Glad to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back with you guys.
So Chuck and I were just talking. I mean, the media, I was in the media for like a million years, and I was a reporter. And if somebody said, Julie, you have to do a story on tariffs, everyone would be like, oh, no, tariffs are so boring. We can't do it. And now the media is all over tariffs, even though none of them really understand it. But it seems to me before we liked tariffs, but now we hate them because Trump likes them. Is that about the state of things?
Well, yeah, I think that is happening. And then that's clearly happening in a very big way. So there's a big part of the community out there in the media and in politics, generally speaking, that is looking for anything they can grab on to try and, inflame criticism of the current administration. Let's put it that way. And so, you know, what's happened with tariffs, what we've seen in the stock market and even in the bond market to a lesser extent as a result of that, you know, has created a great deal of, what appears to be like ammunition to come back at this administration for a lot of things that people don't like with it. Let's put it that way.
But it seems to me it's working, though. I mean, Trump, he announces that everyone's like, oh, all of your prices are going to go up. And then like within hours, 70, 90 countries said, okay, we'll negotiate now, right? I mean, so why don't you kind of explain your column for us? Because you lay out a lot of things in a really good way there.
Yeah, so I've got a couple of columns out now in the newsletter. And in the first one, you know, the key points that I wanted to make in the first one was that, you know, we have to step back and to understand what's really driving a lot of this are the significant trade deficits that have opened up in the United States over the past 30 years or so. And, you know, if we go back into the early 1990s, we were running some trade deficits, which just basically and simply means that we were buying more from other countries than we were selling to other countries. And so historically, we had had balanced trade for a long time. By the early 90s, we had trade deficits, but they were very, very small, at least compared to what's happened since. And then since then, they have become very, very large and an enormous issue, and one that, to his benefit, Trump has been focused on for a very long time, right, while a lot of other people have kind of turned their eyes to it. So, you know, that's what's really driven that. You know, Trump, I think, traveling, seeing some of the disruption that's caused in parts of America that have kind of been left behind over the last 20 or 30 years, I think was a very important political issue for him. It was a very important way for much of middle America, you know, both politically and geographically. It's the reason why they identified with him and why they relate to him.
Right.
So all those things have made it a very important issue, but I think it's also a very misunderstood issue.
Okay.
So many times what we'll hear, you want me to pause for a second?
Yeah, no, go ahead. No, I was going to ask you, go ahead and explain that because I absolutely agree.
Yeah. So, you know, to kind of keep the analysis fairly straightforward, you know, what we tend to hear a lot of is, and this comes from both the left and the right, is that, you know, these deficits are the result of stupid politicians who failed to do anything as all of this occurred. And that's okay. Not completely untrue. There's elements of truth in that. Or on the other side, it's the result of these greedy corporations who couldn't wait to move manufacturing offshore so they could take advantage of very low wage labor markets and kind of use that to stiff the American worker and pad their profit margins. And so one of the first things I try to do in that first post is to say the real driver of this, nobody wants to blame consumers, and they're really not to blame. It's just the way things work, but consumers who are voters. But the real driver of these trade deficits has been the movement of manufacturing into low-cost labor markets. China is the most important of which is what I get into in the second newsletter. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it's gone there is because, you know, hardworking people, they know how hard it is to earn a dollar and to make enough money to try and support themselves and their family. And so they go to the store or to Amazon or wherever it is they go to do some shopping, and they want to get the best value for their money. And so if all of a sudden an extremely low wage labor market opens up somewhere in the world, as was the case with China in the early 1990s. And again, this is the core source of the problem. People have talked about the giant sucking sound coming from Mexico. China is the key source of it, which is I get into in the second newsletter.
Okay.
But people want to get the best value for their money. And so that basically forces manufacturers to move to those markets or to run the risk that they don't and somebody else does and can undercut their prices. And then those manufacturers end up losing a lot of business or even going out of business, which doesn't do anybody any good. You know, the plants still sit idle. The workers still get laid off. And people who've invested in the company, whether it's public shareholders or the owners that founded it, they all lose their money, which reduces the amount of investment and savings the country has to go out and create new jobs. So the dynamics of the system are the real underlying force behind these trade deficits that have become so important is something as simple as consumers wanting to get the best value for their hard-earned dollars.
What though? Let me ask you this, because I'm a giant conspiracy theorist person. How though does, because corporations have choices, how does the growing or what's been a growing sort of global and nationalist economy drive that? In other words, you know, I've read the Conservative Treehouse does a good job. Like I can buy lemons. I can grow lemons in California. I can grow them here in like Mexico, say. But if I grow them in Mexico, but I can use that to manipulate the prices here. So, do you know what I mean? I could be using cheaper prices. And I think, is there any sort of push on the part of some of these global entities that prefer a world economy and could care less really what that does or doesn't do to the economies of individual companies? They just care about their own economy.
I think you're referring to the big companies that are moving manufacturing.
Right.
That, I think. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what they prefer and what is driving them is, you know, first to be successful and to have a growing business that increases in value over time. And in order to do that, they have to provide the best value for whatever products and services they offer to their customers. And so I really think, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are isolated cases or situations, you know, that fit into conspiracy theory type things. But I really think the core underlying driver comes down to the fact that people want the best value for their money. Companies have to provide it or they lose and go out of business. And then all of a sudden, again, if we trace the origins of all of this, in the early 1990s, there was an enormous change in the global labor markets that occurred. And the failure to understand what was really happening there, and I think the failure of almost every administration since then to realize the potential impact of it is and kind of prepare us for it is really the thing that's kind of put us into this situation.
What about the tariffs? I mean, the other countries, because I get the feeling, even this guy on TikTok was saying, you know, which I even understand, and I'm not an economist, that at a certain point, yes, low prices are good, but if the manufacturer, the jobs are going away in this country, then I don't have enough money to go buy whatever it is, no matter how, I mean, there's going to be a balance, right, between the two. And my sense is that's what Trump is trying to do. He's like, look, we're just trying to level the playing field. And the other countries seem willing to negotiate. And the media makes it sound as if all of a sudden prices are going to skyrocket really high. But I don't think, I mean, two-part question. Number one, I don't think it means prices have to skyrocket because it looks like the other companies are willing to negotiate. And the second part of that is, do you think it's going to work?
Yeah. So I think, you know, first of all, I think let's start off from the perspective, you know, I think one thing that has happened here that is very good is that Trump has identified these issues and put them on the table, and we should be dealing with these issues. I think we have a significant problem with China that is both economic and strategic from a military and a global adversary kind of perspective that absolutely needs to be addressed. And you know, what is happening here is exposing that, and that's something that we definitely need to deal with. And at the same time, I think the other thing that has been exposed and identified is that we have developed trading relationships with much of the rest of the world, which from a size and importance standpoint, you know, largely comes down to Europe and to a lesser extent to Mexico and now Vietnam, although what's happening in Mexico and Vietnam is largely a function of what's happened in China. So, but there have been other trading relationships with Europe and others that have evolved since World War II in a way that was more favorable to them initially to try and help them rebuild after World War II. But then even after we rebuilt, nobody sat back down to say, you know, hey, look, we can't leave this in place forever. We've got to sit down and let's balance this thing out. And somebody needs to represent America, which I think has been a big part of his message, and be tough but fair in coming up with a new model that works for us. It works for everybody in America. And it's also fair to them.
Yeah.
And I think that is something else that is very much a necessary thing that has to happen so that we can help ensure that, you know, all Americans have an opportunity to participate in the next wave of economic growth if we can unleash it here.
Okay.
Tell us about what is your views on Smoot-Hawley, which is a...
Smoot-Hawley is one of the things... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Just so people don't already know, it was just we imposed tariffs in 1930. I think Smoot-Hawley passed in order to get more money, quite frankly, into the United States. It has been blamed for exacerbating the Great Depression. It's one of the favorite boogeymen of international trade that if you do Smoot-Hawley, what you get is a depression.
Yes, exactly. And this brings out one of the fascinating things of all of the, you know, this kind of almost mass hysteria that's been created by this debate is one of the interesting things we have is that the administration's not only being attacked by their opponents on the left, but it's being attacked by a fair share of their you know, people you would expect to be allies of theirs on the right and within the Republican Party, which would be kind of the traditional free trade bloc that has used.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we've got a little. We can't hear.
Yeah, Thomas, hey, can you boost the audio? Hang on a second, Ty. Thomas, can you boost the audio there a little bit? We're losing him. Okay. Hey, I'm sorry, Todd. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So let me know if this is.
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, yeah. So Smoot-Hawley you know, Chuck said was the tariffs that were imposed in the 1930s. And I see these brought up time and time again. The phrase that you see over and over throughout the media is these are the most, what Trump is proposing are the most significant tariffs since Smoot-Hawley, which I think is a tool and an intellectually dishonest one used by many people to drum up fears that this is heading us into another Great Depression. And the fact of the matter is that we've long known, even though it was taught that Smoot-Hawley was a big deal for a long time, we have long known Smoot-Hawley was an inconsequential part of leading us into the Great Depression. And so there were two key things that led us into the Depression and made it so deep and why it lasted so long. And neither of those are mistakes that we're repeating right now. One of them is a set of mistakes we're trying to avoid. And that is the Depression was both domestic and international. And the international part of the Depression was driven by World War I and the incredible deficits that were incurred by the major European countries, Germany, France, and Britain, to finance the cost of World War I, which drove their debts up beyond levels that they could afford to repay, and which led to significant inflations of their currencies in ways that they never recovered from, at least not until after World War II. And those problems, which came from extraordinary deficits and debts, were not resolved in the aftermath of the war. They engaged in a great deal of misguided policymaking, which only made matters worse, and which caused the international monetary and financial systems to collapse in the early 1930s. So that's the major cause of the international side of the Great Depression. Then in the United States, what happened was when we started to experience banking panics in late 1930, coincidentally around the time Smoot-Hawley was passed, but not related to Smoot-Hawley, the Federal Reserve made the extraordinary mistake of failing to provide the money that the banking system needed to keep otherwise sound banks from failing because of the panics that were spreading. And the Fed had been created for that reason in 1913. It failed to do its job. And for that reason, we ended up having three severe waves of banking panics, which wiped out by early 1933, had wiped out roughly 40% of the banks in the country. And those could have been avoided if the Fed had just stepped in and done its job. So if the Fed had done its job, we would have had a downturn. It would have been mildly severe. It would never have gotten to the point that it did, and to the depths of what we experienced in the Great Depression. And neither of those things, you know, are in any way similar to what's happening here with these new proposed tariff regimes and that kind of thing. So I think the point of that in that first newsletter was just to say, hey, let's take a breath here. Let's accept the fact that we don't need to go into hysteria because the stock market's down and some people are trying to make us feel like that plus these new tariffs are a recreation of what happened in the 1920s and 1930s.
Well, one of the keys to any issue that's reported historically is the politics of it all. Smoot-Hawley was passed by almost every Republican voting for it, almost every Democrat voting against it. And therefore, it is something, if you're on the left, you love to point to, is because it's the Republicans have to take it on 100%. The one interesting thing about Smoot-Hawley was that after Roosevelt came in, okay, Smoot-Hawley has caused all this huge dislocation. It's bad for us. It's bad for the world. Well, get rid of it. You know, I mean, if you could pass a law imposing it and the additional tariffs are relatively small, about 7%, and only affected about a third of the economy. But just if it's such a huge drag that it's causing the world to go in chaos, you know, you passed it, get rid of it. But they didn't. They maintained it. They didn't think it was the cause of all this awfulness on economies and the world.
They would have done something about it if they did.
They would have done it and quickly corrected it. So it's a wonderful boogeyman if you're on the left. And if you're on the right, well, you know, you just want to pretend it's not there. But it's amazing how little Smoot-Hawley had the effect of Smoot-Hawley, the amount of the increase in tariffs. And so you kind of go, well, huh. So it came after the fall of the stock market. It was passed in 1930, which means it would not take effect until sometime in 1931. So it could not have caused the Depression. Now, did it exacerbate it to make it last a lot longer? And that's always an interesting question. And that sort of falls into what do you think that FDR's New Deal policies did? Did they greatly allow us to return to prosperity? Or they were something that, in fact, prevented us from coming out a lot sooner and a lot more strongly. I mean, generally speaking, the New Deal policies, at least in my, in my mind, were a disaster. They were a disaster. And they simply continued, exacerbated the Great Depression as it was. But I love economics because, you know, nobody really knows what happens. If they did, they would have made it a true science and everybody quickly follow it and be very happy and live everybody else.
And then they corrupt it like climate change. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, they will corrupt it like climate change.
Well, that's already happened, I think, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's...
They use it as a tool to promote whatever agenda that they're looking to promote, kind of thing. Yeah.
And moreover, you know, international trade, only a portion of it for these deficits and imbalances is caused by the tariffs imposed by countries. Certainly manipulating the currency, certainly have governments flooding underpriced goods. There are a dozen different things that really cause those trade imbalances and tariffs. And I think Trump was fairly bright saying, I don't care what your tariff rate is. I care what the imbalance in trade relationship is. And if you have one that's consistently very, very deleterious to us, we're gonna do what we need to do to bring it back in line. And once you get it back in line, it'll probably need to be adjusted periodically all the time. But certainly China, who pulls every lever you can possibly do, they understand the economic system. And it isn't just the tariffs. And they've managed ever since they got into the WTO and 2000 to manipulate while the United States and other countries just sit there fat, dumb, and happy. And then they wake up and go, hey, didn't we used to have some manufacturing plants around here?
Well, you know, exactly. And that leads us into China, which was the key focus of the second piece, you know, that I put out on Friday. And I think what many people have missed is that the reason that China has become such an extraordinarily large player on the global stage. If you go back to 1990, their economy was roughly 6% of the size of ours. And today it is roughly a little over 60% of the size of our economy. So, and if you go as recently as 2015, China accounted for basically half of our trade deficit in goods. So this is,
wow. You know,
this is the great sucking sound. People have talked about Mexico. China is the great sucking sound of where have those jobs gone and why has all of this occurred? And this didn't happen because the Chinese, as many people claim, you know, came up with some new and brilliant way to mix communist central planning with free market activity in just the right way to enable this rapid rise. This happened because of the failure of central planning. And central planning in China pushed that country to the brink of disaster in the 1970s. When Mao died in 1976, there were over 500 million people living on less than $2 a day.
Ooh.
they started to open their markets up, but they really weren't accepted into the world trading system at that point in time because the Soviet Union was still out there and nobody wanted to, like, say, invest in a factory in China when there was a risk that Soviet tanks would roll in and confiscate everything. So they started to grow a little bit. But then when the Soviet Union collapsed because of how dysfunctional its centrally planned economy was, that removed that threat. And all of a sudden, with China having been gradually, being worked into the global economy on a very modest basis, all of a sudden money started to flow into China from around the Western world to build manufacturing facilities, plants, and infrastructure that enabled their growth. And that growth happened because their wages were still extraordinarily low. They were still looking at, GDP. Their GDP as a whole was like $360. Their GDP per capita was like $300 at this point in time. Huh. Ours was in the $23,000-$24,000. So all of these impoverished people had very low wage expectations. And that's been the primary source of this growth. And the huge mistake that people in the West made, all of us for the most part, was that we failed to realize how extraordinary the impact would be of trying to absorb a country of over a billion people. This wasn't a small country. Over a billion people into an economy, in a Western economy, that was currently supporting roughly 600 million people in the United States and Europe combined. So again, going back to 1990, China's population was not quite, but almost two times the size of the Western world, US and Europe, and their GDP per capita was about 1.5% of what it was in the US and EU combined. So wow. This is what enabled the rise. After the fall of the Soviet Union, there was this hope and expectation and this euphoria that free trade would lead to democracy and free countries, and it didn't work out that way.
No.
If the Chinese government was only willing to let those things run as long as it was in the interest of the Communist Party, and as soon as they needed to, they cracked down. And, starting with Xi back, roughly a decade ago, they started to become a much more antagonistic trading partner, not really partner, antagonist. And so, to me, this is the really big and core issue strategically that we need to address. We defeated the Soviet Union by isolating their economy and prohibiting it from participating in the Western economy. And we made the mistake with China, or we lost the trade war to China because we failed to do that. We failed to isolate, their economy, and by doing so, we allowed them to grow so much and become such a big factor here.
Hey, and Todd, I hate to do this, but we've got to let you go here. That was great. We've taken up too much of your time, I think. And the China part, it's the second part on your newsletter of Wealth, On Wealth and Progress. And people can get that. They can just go to Substack, right, and put in On Wealth and Progress, and you'll come on up.
Yeah, put in On Wealth and Progress and or my name, and it should come up. And like you said, these are available for the bargain price of free right now. So I encourage as many people who are interested to sign up. You'll at least get your money's worth, right?
There you go.
All right.
No tariffs.
Thanks
now.
So much for joining us, and we'll have you back.
It was a pleasure to be with you again.
All right. Thank you there. Todd Sheets. On Wealth and Progress, there's just so much going on with the tariffs. And I think it's funny, the left is twisting it all to try to make Trump look bad. And in the end, it's not. All of a sudden, they have to report, oh, okay, all these countries are negotiating. And it isn't, CNN, it's not like a one soundbite kind of topic either. So, can we switch gears, Tucker? Did you have anything else you wanted? Okay, so this is kind of, we'll talk about the governor's race here in a second, but I just wanted
there's
to play.
One thing. Okay. And this is really not apropos of anything, but
just on your mind.
I think we need to bring indictments down and start jailing McKinsey and Company executives and others.
McKinsey the Economist?
Company, yeah, well, they're responsible for two incredible trends. One of moving everything to China from United States. If you had, and I represented some, you know, small to medium-sized companies who would never think about trading overseas. You know, they weren't big enough, they weren't sophisticated enough. And McKinsey would come, oh, no, we have the contacts, no problem. Why don't we have all your widgets made in China? Why don't you start a small plant over there and you can do that? And we have all the expertise for that because the company wouldn't have it. I mean,
right.
And so they alone, just the great sucking sound of McKinsey and Company. And then they added to that their incredible study that DEI was the greatest thing ever. It's going to really help your company.
Oh, and they sold it to Bud Light. Well, and yeah, you know, it's sort of on a side note.
You got to have your DEI. We've got a whole DEI staff for you. And we
what's crazy is
DEI
the woman.
Executives, and you'll be all set. And boy, will your company grow once you have everybody at each other's throat, because you do it by identity politics. But,
well, and you know, it must work sometimes. So this, you know, Liv Goff, which I think is struggling right now, hired, I don't know if you saw this, the woman who was responsible for tanking Bud Light by hiring the transsexual person and then trashing the
Alicia
clients.
Alicia Heidenschild.
Whatever her name is, Liv hired her to be their main PR person. I'm like, good luck with that. Good luck with
that. Now we're going to have the training golfers anytime.
I don't know. I would just not that. I mean, I don't know what on earth the person responsible for really one of the worst PR disasters in modern times. Why would you hire that person? Call me crazy. I'm just like, I don't know. I mean, your kindergartner could probably come up with a better ad campaign. Wanted to talk about, this was kind of fun today, more winning. So, you know, there's been this ongoing feud over this El Salvadoran illegal immigrant who was one of the Tren de Aragua, or was it MS-13? I forget, one of the violent criminal gang organizations, deported twice, had orders to deport, so Trump deports him. And all of a sudden, he's like, you know, a working class father, blah, 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 right? Church-going kind of guy. And the judge demanded that Trump bring the guy back, all of that, right? Even though that's not what the Supreme Court said. Well, so the president of El Salvador is visiting Trump at the White House today. And as Trump does, they have the big, you know, what used to be with Biden, a 30-second photo op where all the reporters were shooed out. Now people can ask questions. And Caitlin Collins from CNN started to ask a question, and Trump told her she couldn't ask a question. And that was kind of funny. But then Stephen Miller just schools these people. They're like, they're asking the president of El Salvador, oh, are you going to send him back? And they're telling Trump, are you going to tell him that we're going to go get him? And Stephen Miller just schools these people. So, Thomas, if we could please play the Stephen Miller soundbite.
There's an illegal alien from El Salvador. So, with respect to you, he's a citizen of El Salvador. So, it's very arrogant even for American media to suggest that we would even tell El Salvador how to handle their own citizens as a starting point. As two immigration courts found that he was a member of MS-13. When President Trump declared MS-13 to be a foreign terrorist organization, that meant that he was no longer eligible under federal law, which I'm sure you know, you're very familiar with the INA, that he was no longer eligible for any form of immigration relief in the United States. So he had a deportation order that was valid, which meant that under our law, he's not even allowed to be present in the United States and had to be returned because of the foreign terrorist designation. This issue was then, by a district court judge, completely inverted, and a district court judge tried to tell the administration that they had to kidnap a citizen of El Salvador and fly him back here. That issue was raised to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said the district court order was unlawful, and its main components were reversed 9-0 unanimously, stating clearly that neither Secretary of State nor the President could be compelled by anybody to forcibly retrieve a citizen of El Salvador from El Salvador, who again is a member of MS-13, which, as I'm sure you understand, rapes little girls, murders women, murders children, is engaged in the most barbaric activities in the world. And I can promise you, if he was your neighbor, you would move right away.
So you don't plan to ask for him to get him back?
But the Supreme Court is asking to
And what was the ruling in the Supreme Court, Steve? Was it 9-0?
Yes, it was a 9-0.
Yeah. In our favor.
In our favor, against the district court ruling, saying that no district court has the power to compel the foreign policy function of the United States. As Pam said, the ruling solely stated that if this individual at El Salvador's sole discretion was sent back to our country, that we could deport him a second time. No version of this legally ends up with him ever living here, because he is a citizen of El Salvador. That is the president of El Salvador. Your questions about it from the court can only be directed to him.
Well, I'm supposed to have suggested that I smuggle a terrorist into the United States, right? How can I return him to the United States? Like, could I smuggle him into the United States, or what do I do? Of course, I'm not going to do it.
It's like, so Stephen Miller says, okay, so what you're suggesting, you moron reporters, is that we go to El Salvador, break this guy out of prison, kidnap him, and bring him back to the United States
where he can't be under
federal law anyway. And then so they said, El Salvador, why don't you send him home? And he's like, wait, well, he's a designated terrorist. So you want me, who can't be in the United States, so you want me to now smuggle a terrorist into the United States? And the reporters are like, oh, that's not how we see it. It's kind of funny. and I think, and again, the media was twisting the thing. The Supreme Court, basically, that's what they said, right? They said, you know, no, no district judge can tell the president, go kidnap some guy out of El Salvador, nor can a district judge in wherever tell some president of El Salvador smuggle a terrorist back in the United States. So I thought that was just kind of fun. Also today, then switching to the governor's race, I came up with a new theory over the weekend. So on Friday, I think we told you that Senator Michael Bennett, who Charlene gave us his incredible bio, was going to be running for governor. And suddenly I thought to myself, you know, if you're going to run, Michael Bennett ran for president once, very briefly, right? And if you want to run for president, it's a lot easier to run for president having been a governor, I think, than a senator. Senators, nobody likes senators. And I thought to myself, I bet... Your theory is a little different, so I'll give you a chance. I'll bet what Michael Bennett really wants to do is run for president. So he's going to come, be governor for maybe, you know, a little while, who knows how long, and then use the governor's platform to jump into running for president. What do you think, Chuck?
Well, I mean, it won't be a little while. I mean, yeah. You have the 2028 election, so that's 3+ years from now. So that's more than just a little while.
He may stay for 2 terms if he wants to.
Well, yeah, he could. He could last. But I think he would like to run for president. He's done it before. I think he's bored in Washington. There's people who will tell you, you know, senators, you know, you're told how to vote more or less most
right.
of the time. You don't really debate issues. And most of them just, in the past, anyway, would drink themselves a lot. Maybe not these days. Maybe they run a lot in marathons if they're not in a hospice from old age. but I think he wants a little excitement. He wants a little fun in life. Come on. You know, not sleepy old U.S. Senate.
Well, and I see a two-part. So, and what's interesting is, and we're going to get, because this has become controversial, the Denver Post did a sort of an anti-Michael Bennett not resigning story. So Bennett says, well, I will remain senator because I don't actually, he didn't say it, but the truth is, he said, I don't actually really do anything as a senator. So I'll be totally able to campaign for governor and run for, and to remain being a senator at the same time. And plus, once I become governor, which I almost certainly will, then I'm going to appoint the next senator. My thinking is he doesn't want Jared Polis to run against him for president. So they're going to flip flop, right? Michael Bennett will become governor. Jared Polis has already been in Congress. Now he'll become a senator. Either that or Brittany Pedersen. But I think if you're Michael Bennett, you want to get Jared Polis off the table. So I just foresee that happening. What do you think of that?
Well, I love Michael Bennett's thinking ahead, you know. Go, oh, great. Yeah. And I can appoint who's the next senator. It'll be a friend of mine.
Right.
Guaranteed. And I don't know if he's a friend with Polis, or maybe he's a friend with Brittany Pedersen, or maybe he has some other friend he'd like to make a senator. But, I mean, since we're a one-party state, yeah. You know, it's all possible. You know, the Republicans don't have anything to say about it.
Now, I don't think somebody, so the Denver Post, and this is what's also interesting, the Denver Post had an editorial today demanding that Michael Bennett resign if he's going to resign as senator, if he's going to run, saying that he faces a vigorous primary against Phil Weiser, which I don't think is true at all. My prediction is that Weiser will drop out. I mean, I don't know. Is he the favorite of the very progressive wing of the Democrats? I don't think Michael Bennett is, but I just, if you're Weiser, I mean, the Democrats don't like primaries, right? Someone will, maybe they'll send Weiser to a prison in El Salvador or something like that. But do you see Weiser staying in?
You know, he's not going anywhere.
Maybe he'll get to be senator. I don't know.
Yeah, he's not going anywhere.
But I think, though, the Post editorial I thought was just odd that they were saying he shouldn't run. He should resign. I mean, they have a point. And this comes at a time, too, where the Democrats are. This is a typical Democrat thing, right? So rather than resign and let there be an election and people elect the senator, Michael Bennett's going to get elected, then appoint the senator who will then have a whole no one will have voted for this person. I mean, the typical Democrat, right? They just create vacancies and then they fill a vacancy and then they shuffle everybody around. I mean, I could see a scenario where he appoints Brittany Patterson, then somebody's got to appoint somebody over there in CD7 to replace Brittany Patterson. I mean, I don't know. It creates sort of the Democrats. It's like they hate pesky elections, right? So they just try to shift everybody around.
Why? They win them all, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. But I think that's actually what's going to happen. Let's see. Wait, let me move down. We had some comments. Let's see. Okay, from Charlene. Since Bennett used to work for Anschutz, do you think Anschutz will back the Rhino candidate or Bennett? I think Anschutz won't play because if you're Anschutz, you don't care. If it's a Rhino candidate or Bennett, you're happy either way. So I think Anschutz won't play, which will, I think, hurt the Rhino candidate because Bennett's going to have all the money he needs. The Rhino candidate is not going to have any money, don't you think?
Yeah, he'll run the Joe O'Day campaign, lose by 20 points. The Hike and All campaign, lose by 20 points. I mean,
Yeah. Yeah, I think, well, and here's some of this too from Charlene. He'll be able to continue doing nothing as senator. And then, yeah, if Weiser will take Bennett's place and will support Bennett for governor, that's true. Then Charlene says, I hope they compete each other and have an actual primary so the Dems won't switch over and vote for the Rhino candidate in the primary. Yeah, I don't know, Charlene. And speaking of candidates, and I don't want to say Rhino because I don't think any of the candidates we've seen on the Republican side so far are Rhinos. So we've got Scott Bottoms, who's announced he's running. Mark Baisley has announced he's running for governor. We're hearing rumors. Ken DeGraff is at least considering it. But Greg Lopez has now officially said he's going to run for governor again for the third time. You know, there'll be... I think Scott Bottoms and Mark Baisley would have to go the assembly route, right? Greg Lopez probably has made enough contacts. Oh, he's got enough support. He could do both. I mean, what do you see so far? What do you think, Chuck?
Well, I mean, all it takes to get on from the ballot is signatures, which just requires money. All the people you've mentioned are fairly conservative, and so they probably fare well in an assembly, but you know, with three of them, who knows who would come out the best there. I still can't figure this out. Why do you want to run for position? You can't, in all likelihood, you know, Las Vegas odds are 10 to 1, 20 to 1 against you. What is it, you know, what is the fun part of running and getting your head handed to you?
Although, because I've had conversations with some of these people, number one, I think they care and they don't necessarily assume that they would lose. I think there's a sense that you look at what's happening. I'm not saying, to be honest, I kind of agree with you. I think any Republican running for a statewide office is facing an incredibly difficult task, not because people don't like their ideas, but because of the election system in Colorado, because of the corruption, as we've seen, the lack of election integrity throughout. You know, Jenna Griswold will be mailing postcards to 30,000 illegal immigrants who all live at one address, which is right next to a Democrat NGO. You know what I mean? And with ballot harvesting. But they would say, I think that, you know, given the mood of the country, given how awful things are getting in Colorado, that there would be... Oops, I'm getting Dr. Donna. I'm looking at my text that they think they would have a chance. So, let's see. Okay, so you know, Dr. Donna, I don't want to hang on. So I'm reading text. Okay, guys, Dr. Donna has a thing. Okay, we do. I think it's confirmed. Okay, so Joy Overbeck, who I have disagreed with always. On many things, apparently passed away. Okay, she had emergency open heart surgery and died in the procedure. Dr. Donna said she didn't want to say anything unless confirmed. So let me make this clear. We have not confirmed it, but in looking at texts and other things, it appears that this is true. So that would be sad.
Yeah, it would be sad. I'm not, politically we disagreed intensely, but that'd be way too bad.
Yeah, that would be very sad. That would be very sad. So we'll find out more about that. Okay. And then, so back to the topic, because I don't want to go too much into that. I've learned a long time ago as a reporter, it is much easier to have somebody die a little bit later than to bring somebody back from the dead. So, I have a sense of looking at all of these comments that it's correct, which is very sad. Back to the thing, Julie is from Charlene. Julie's on top of it. Illegals living next door to an NGO. One of the things, though, that's what going to be voting. I mean, it's really not funny because it's true. You know, I mean, Mike O'Donnell does great work at saying, here's an address. And there's literally like 40 people, all of them, you know, with hyphenated Mexican-American names or Mexican names, you know, all live at the same address, even though it has like one bedroom, right? And none of, so it's kind of like the Act Blue people where somebody keeps donating over and over again and they had no idea. These people are voting over and over again and they have no idea, which helps the Democrats. But anyway, Chuck, that was a long and babbling answer. I'm sorry about that to your question as to why they would run. But I do know the people I've talked to are sincere about it, right? I think they think that
mean
maybe
they're sincere about it. It's got to be something where you get to siphon off all the money for your friends or your
I don't think any of the people I mentioned are those kind of guys.
You want to be campaigning for something you don't have any chance of doing.
I don't think they think there's not a chance.
And then get your head handed to you.
It's
got to be. I promise you, there's a trick to it. And
no,
when you get Greg Lopez or one of these guys to fess up.
Not
what it is.
Not from these guys. So, hey, that is going to wrap it up. Do you have anything else you wanted to talk about today? I know Chuck is at World Headquarters putting out the paper. So,
I've got tons of stuff,
editor.
We've got a long week, and so we can get lots of stuff. But we got to have Todd Sheets back. That was fun.
Oh, he's great. And he explained it very well, too. Yeah, Charlene, Chuck is in an underground bunker.
Yeah. An undisclosed location.
An undisclosed location. Hey, that'll do it for us, everybody. Thank you to Todd and everybody on Zoom. And we will see everybody on Wednesday.
Bye-bye.